It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton that left 31 dead and dozens more injured have shocked the nation. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In El Paso, where 22 were killed and 24 were injured by Patrick Crucius, he opened fire after posting his concerns about an Hispanic invasion of Texas. In Dayton, Ohio, Connor Betts shot and killed 12 people, wounded 14 more. The FBI says he was exploring what they called violent ideologies. Meanwhile, the shootings and President Trump's visits to the cities have come amid a storm of political outrage by Democratic candidates and sharp tweets from the president. Here in Salisbury, a vigil was held last night at the Asbury United Methodist Church to grieve for the loss of life. In our studio this morning is Tom Passmore, senior pastor at Asbury United Methodist Church, and John Wright, the pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And to take a look at the politics and civil liberties issues is Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin. Welcome all to the program.
Thank you.
So we're going to give at least a little sense of what it was like last night at that vigil, and then we'll come back.
The music echoed against the walls of the Asbury United Methodist Church in Salisbury, and a small audience gathered to mark the shootings in El Paso and Dayton that took 31 lives and wounded dozens of others. Pastor Tom Passmore stood to welcome those from many other churches who chose to attend the vigil.
Good evening, friends, and welcome to Asbury United Methodist Church as we gather together in prayer. It is my pleasure to be the host tonight, but we've got other churches and other clergy.
And for Passmore, there was a personal connection to these kinds of shootings.
When the Newtown shootings happened, when Sandy Hook took place, I had a son who was a kindergartner. And I know the ages of the kids that were killed in that event, and it hit close to home. Many of us feel the pain that those families in Dayton and El Paso are feeling.
There was also a call and response denouncing violence, followed by a reading the names of the towns that have been hit by gun violence.
El Paso, Texas. Dayton, Ohio. Gilroy, California. Virginia Beach. Virginia.
For many who attended, there was a sense of shock at the carnage of last weekend. For Suzanne Perry Loss, it was...
I just feel so much sympathy and empathy for these victims and the whole situation of gun violence. Just not again, and oh, how horrific.
And then there was Dr. Charlie Stegman.
My immediate reaction is, oh, no, not again. And it's just too much.
Meanwhile, Scott Duncan said there was a sense of numbness.
It's one of those things that's just become so commonplace that you're almost inured to the fact that it happens. Not certainly to the loss of life, but and frustration that something isn't being done.
But above all, said Arlene White, it was a time of remembrance for those whose lives were lost.
I think it's important for us to remember the people who perished due to violence.
President Trump visited El Paso and Dayton this week, meeting with officials and making stops at the hospitals where the wounded were being treated. But some refused to meet with the nation's chief executive. Meanwhile, there were protest rallies as Democratic presidential candidates condemned the president, some even calling him a white supremacist. The alleged shooter in El Paso even echoed some of the president's words about invasion from immigrants. For those at the church, it was clear that some felt much of the blame fell on his shoulders. Jenny Weiss.
I blame our president. Sit there, you watch the funerals and everything, and you cry. And then he doesn't seem to have any empathy.
As did Suzanne Perry Loss.
I think he certainly does affect how people respond and behave. He's a leader, and words make a difference.
Others in the audience blame the shooting on the failure to pass some form of gun control. Currently, there are proposals for so-called red flag laws that would allow authorities to take guns from those who were deemed a danger, as well as a push for background checks. Tom Keller.
I think there's going to be a time when we will not have pistols and other kinds of armed pieces of steel that take people's lives. we can't let it go on like this.
But despite the president's suggestion that he might back some form of background checks, there is doubt that the Senate would approve such a measure. Dr. Charlie Stegman, who has been working on gun control issues, believes that there is movement building to finally enact some kind of legislation.
After we get more leadership there and different leadership there, I think all this will accumulate and finally tip the balance. That's my hope.
A number of attendees noted, however, that the political atmosphere goes beyond simply the president or guns. Charles Emery believes that much of the anger now on display comes from those who feel threatened.
I think we're in a time when people are feeling very threatened about their position, and they're lashing out in dangerous and inappropriate ways.
And he notes that this is not the first time the country has seen this kind of anger or even violence.
We've passed through it before. It happened in the 20s. It happened, you know, probably some years after an economic dislocation.
But Barbara Emery points to something new in this 21st century environment, social media.
What is new is the extent of the reach and the ability of people on the margin to gather together and organize. And that's different.
As for those who came to this elegant church with its red carpet and tall windows, it was a time to reflect and gather together. Pastor Pasmore.
When violence affects one community, it affects other communities. And we just want to pull Salisbury together and have this opportunity to grieve and to mourn and to pray. And then if people feel led, our motto here is faith in action. We want people to take action if that's what they feel called to do.
This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio.
And that, of course, were some of the people who were attending the vigil last night. And I wanted to turn to Pastor Pasmore. Tell me a little bit about how this vigil came about, what your own personal feelings were about what happened in El Paso and Dayton.
On Sunday, we didn't really have an opportunity to respond because things had happened so late on Saturday. And one of our associates, Kristen, who helped to lead the service last night, came to me and said, you know, I feel compelled. We've got to do something. And she said, I think God is calling us to do a prayer vigil. And I said, you're absolutely right. So we got a team together and just began to talk about what that might look like. And Kristen did a lot of the hard work. And then she sent a post out on Facebook, and that seemed to just go viral across the community. It was handed out by a number of different people through their connections, and we were able to get over 80 people there last night. It was such a blessing to see the community respond in that way.
As I mentioned, by the way, in the story, you have a certain personal connection with Sandy Hook.
Yeah, it was not direct. It was more indirect. My son was the same age as the kids that were killed, and when I read it in the paper, I couldn't do anything else but weep and just break down. And my wife did too. We just talked about it for the rest of that day. What would it be like to lose a child in such a horrific way? And just the outpouring of pain and grief that we had, it really galvanized us to work on nonviolence and to move forward doing that.
What, by the way, when you heard about the shooting, and we've heard a number of these shootings, but the numbers that had died are really actually quite startling. What was your own personal reaction above and beyond being, you know, obviously a pastor of a church?
I echo with what we heard in the story that it's not again. Here we are over and over and over again. It just seems to keep happening. And I was just devastated. And I also echo with that person that spoke about being numb. That we as a country have often become numb. It's only 9 people. It's only 22 people. And I think last night allowed us to feel some of that pain again, because without that pain present, there's no impetus to move and to act.
John, I want to turn to you with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. What was your own personal reaction when you heard the news, obviously, and what did the vigil help?
My personal reaction, much like Tom's, was not again. But the reality is that gun violence in this country, the mass shootings get all the attention, but it is far deeper than that. About 600 women per year are murdered by their partners. It's the statistics are staggering, and so in addition to everything else, honestly, I'm angry. I'm angry that we keep doing it over and over again and nothing gets done. And last night, I think for me, that vigil was important on a number of levels, but I think the most profound part of that vigil, at least for me, was there was a... they had set up these two metal bars, and they invited the congregation to come, and they had hammers and bang on those metal bars. And that was profound for me in terms of being able to express some of that anger and outrage, and hearing that clanging of people, of others, banging on those bars and hearing their outrage. I think that for me was perhaps the most important, or at least touching, part of that whole service.
Do you think that there is some change going on in the country in terms of gun violence, for one, but maybe even the political rhetoric, which we'll talk about in a few minutes? Or is there a change? Are we moving through a period?
I would like to believe that is true. Unfortunately, you know, when these mass shootings happen, there's this rhetoric. Everyone is, you know, speaking about change and speaking about change and speaking about change, and then it doesn't actually happen. We go back to our regular lives without thinking about the fact that, in fact, you know, we're killing ourselves and each other, not just at those moments when the mass shootings happen, but every day it's happening. And that doesn't seem to be changing. It's certainly not on the level that I would like to see.
What a turn to you, Michael Laughlin. What do you make of, well, first of all, what was your own personal reaction to it? I know you're a pacifist, amongst other things, but that not only were these shootings, which seem now to be very regular and even connected in some fashion to some ideology, but that they, I think in the case of Dayton, the people were killed within about 32 seconds.
Yeah. Unsurprising. I mean, I teach my policy class at Salisbury University, and one of the things we talk about in public policy is forecasting problems. And these recent massacres are entirely predictable. With no change in public policy, we can anticipate more. We've anticipated some in the past. So in that respect, as horrific as they were, and they were unsurprising in terms of the phenomena itself.
What we seem to be having in part at this moment in time, maybe it'll change down the road, is that there is almost a marriage between the shootings on the one hand and what we see as extremist rhetoric and extremist groups on the other. One can connect them with the president if one likes. And I recall the same kind of thing occurring, for instance, in the mid-1990s, in which there was this ginning up of right-wing groups. And then, of course, there was this punctuation point with Timothy McVeigh and the bombing of Oklahoma City. Historically, what are we looking at? Because, I mean, and Charles Emory suggested that these things happen, you know, almost regularly after traumatic experiences.
Well, I think that there's it's unquestionably that the white supremacy groups have been growing and certainly fueled by this president's rhetoric and his analysis of the problems and the like. And coupled with, I think, the continued growth in the access to guns, and certainly the automatic weapons. But as John rightly points out, pistols continue to be the major killer of most people who are killed by guns. Hmm. I think that dynamic is continuing, and we've had periods, of course. You know, the 1994, Bill Clinton pushed through the ban on automatic weapons, on these AK-47 type weapons.
Yeah, semi-automatics, yeah.
Yeah, and But that was, of course, that generated a reaction from, and this is where I think that, on the one hand, public opinion has been moving clearly in general in favor of new gun laws. There's no question about that. But the veto point, of course, has been with the National Rifle Association, and they're very effective, both lobbying the money that they have contributed to candidates, political candidates, and of course the votes that they have been able to rally. And some analysts argue, I think persuasively, that the 1994 overturn of the Democratic majority came in large part on the gun issue. So that even today, Democrats, particularly Democrats who are come from rural areas like Wacomico County or whatever in our area, they are hesitant and reluctant to embrace really powerful gun control laws for fear of the reaction from the gun rights advocates and the National Rifle Association.
Now, there's been talk, for instance, on Capitol Hill, the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has talked about bringing forth at least a debate on some of the legislation, red flag laws, background checks. We're not sure whether or not the ban on assault weapons will get there. The president has indicated that he seems to be seeing something of a shift going on, at least temporarily, in terms of his own personal views. How do you think that's going to play out? Or are we just going to get a lot of debate and then at the end it'll die?
Yes.
It's going, right.
Don't hold your breath. I think that we've been through this dynamic before. There's really no indication at this point that the Republican Party, and the Republican Party presently is in the bag for with the National Rifle Association. It's very, very clear. We know what the answers are. Public policy, other countries have been able to slam the door on this kind of violence, so that it is not a mystery as to what we need as a country need to do, but the politics presently prevents that from happening.
Pastor, I want to turn to you because the issue of, are we passing through a period of time? Are we, what do you make of this political moment, and not just some terms of politics, but in terms of how we are relating to one another?
I think things do happen in a cycle. I think that's evident from what we see in terms of Scripture and the way that it talks about the nation of Israel as an example of approaching God and then backing away. I think we see some of those things repeat time after time. And one of the struggles is how to break those cycles. We see generations of families within the church that have dealt with a variety of different things, whether it be addiction or violence, and those seem to perpetuate through the generations. It's how do you break those cycles? So I think it's going to take, in addition to work on policy level, work for those of us who are in local churches and community-based groups to change hearts and to continue to work at a local level on the things that we can affect, as well as doing the work on a national level and on a political front to make change happen.
By the way, you indicate, by the way, in the interview, you said that this is a moment of prayer, but if you want to take some action, that's maybe the second half. What do we elaborate a little bit about that?
Sure. When we talk about faith in action, it really is prayer gives us the strength and the power and the encouragement, the hope to go out and do something about it. So, we advocated last night for people to do something. We had a handout that went out with those that came to the prayer vigil, inviting them to first and foremost care for the victims who have been affected by these tragedies and gun violence wherever it may happen. For Dayton and El Paso, there are community foundations where donations can be made to assist victims. And we invited people to write letters to them, care of those foundations for the victims or those families that have been affected. So that's an effective way to connect people. And then there was also information about if people want to take political action or people want to take other action in the community for them to do that as well.
Pastor Wright, what about you? Is this a momentary thing? Are we going to be locked in here for another 10 years with this stuff? We have the guns, which is one element, but the other element, which seems to be rapidly rising, is this marriage with an ideology.
In faith communities, we talk a lot about prophetic voice, having a prophetic voice, and I believe, this is traditions handed down from the very earliest days of religious experience. That is, our obligation as people of faith is to have courage and speak out for truth and righteousness. I'm sounding like an Old Testament preacher here.
Amen, brother.
And courage requires that we speak out for what is right in spite of the consequences. And I think that that's, Michael, when you were talking about our leaders, that's what's required, is that they speak out, you know, stop worrying about whether or not they're going to be reelected and start speaking out with a prophetic voice, which all of us need to do. That's what you were talking about last night with supporting those who are hurting and also taking a stand and letting people know that it has gone on long enough. And I don't think that that's, I don't think that's a temporary thing. I think that's what we as people of faith are required to do day in, day out, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You see this as an ongoing struggle.
Oh, yeah. Amen, brother. It absolutely is.
Michael, I want to turn to you because one of the issues is not only guns, but there has been a call for some kind of action taken against domestic terrorism. We know that some of the offices have been dismantled within the Justice Department when it comes to domestic terrorism. We heard earlier, actually, on Delmarva Today, or Delmarva Public Radio, the comptroller, Peter Francho, talk about we got to go in, we got to interrogate these people, we got to arrest them. Obviously, there's a First Amendment issue. How does all that play out? Because this is far more complicated than, say, dealing with international terrorism, where the government says, or the State Department says, this is a terrorist group, so now if you're associated with it, right? But I don't think you can do that domestically.
Be careful what you wish for. I'd encourage your listeners to reread some of their history on the program called COINTELPRO, mm-hmm. which was a counterintelligence program started back in the 50s by J. Edgar Hoover, who was then director, of course, of the FBI, and it was sustained all the way through the early 1970s. And the focus of the FBI's program was to ferret out groups that were deemed subversive to the United States. And of course, who did they focus on? Martin Luther King, civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, feminist organizations, environmentalist organizations. And they pursued all kinds of tactics, such as witness tampering, break-ins of houses, so that we had all kinds of violations of fundamental, not only First Amendment rights of free speech and freedom of association, but of course Fourth Amendment rights of privacy and the protection of your home. I think we need to be careful. To be sure, we need to counter the rise of supremacist groups. But I think we ought to be careful not to rely on state power much to do that, because the history is not good, particularly now when we have Trump, President Trump, who clearly favors, is sympathetic to the white supremacist groups themselves, who clearly is pushing to get more control over the FBI and these intelligence organizations. It was reported just today in the Washington Post that the next in line for the counterintelligence folks, I believe her name was Gordon, is resigning. And Trump is going to be trying to push somebody else in there, again, working to get control, get political control of the FBI. So I think more than those kinds of changes in policy, it really is the gun policy. The gun policy is what we really should be focused on principally. And we can do other things to counter, I think, the rise of white supremacy.
I guess one of the questions is that, particularly since the 9/11, that we are shifting law enforcement-wise to intelligence and preventiveness. And we certainly have seen that when it comes to international terrorism. It seems to me that there is a shift going on here where we're not talking about a crime that's been committed and therefore, you know, the FBI goes in. but that they're actually talking about trying to explore some of these groups. And people outside will say, well, look, you know, you're talking, I mean, unlike, for instance, Martin Luther King, we're talking about people who are advocating violence, which is a much different proposition than, and particularly in an age of social media.
Yes, and I think that to the extent that law enforcement agencies walk that line and focus and do have a focus on violent-prone organizations, that I think is quite proper that we pass law and pass policy to ensure that they do that. But due diligence is important here because, again, I want to underscore the history tells us that this abuse of power is not simply exercised by presidents, but it can be clearly exercised by the FBI, the CIA, and other instruments of the state.
Just quickly, do you think there's enough checks and balances within this 18th century document?
presently, not. No, I don't, actually.
So finally, Tom, I want to just wrap up with you. Any final thoughts about what you would say to people who are thinking about what happened in El Paso and Dayton?
What struck me over the last 24 hours is, as we've gone through the prayer vigil and as I've thought about all the things that have happened in the last week, you know, we as Christians, our tradition talks about sacrifice. Jesus sacrificed himself on our behalf. And, you know, one of the things that we're missing, I think, in modern dialogue is a willingness to sacrifice. We are so entrenched in our positions and so deeply enmeshed in the way that we feel and think that it's hard for us to see the common good. And I think until we can get to a point where we can help the community understand that sometimes we don't personally do things that are the best in our behalf so that the community itself can flourish, we've struggled with that as a country. And I'm praying that that changes.
We were speaking with Tom Passmore. He is the senior pastor at Asbury United Methodist Church, also John Wright, pastor at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and also Michael Laughlin. He is the Salisbury University political science professor here, and appreciate all of you talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. It's known as science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, and as part of a program that's also been involved with the Virginia Space in Wallops Island. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The development of STEM programs began after a report called Rising Above the Gathering Storm that looks at the knowledge-intensive programs and how to get students involved. This morning we have Chad Pavlikovich. He is with NextGen. Also, that's a Wacomico County School STEM program. Also, Dr. Stephen Benz. He's a Salisbury University physics professor. And else, well, he is involved with ThinStat. We'll talk a little bit about what that is as well. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let me just start with the idea of the background of STEM and how that comes about. I mentioned, alluded a moment ago to the fact that we had this report. There's this concern about developing particularly the skills and the knowledge of students to get them involved in this kind of research so that we can be competitive. Chad, what about that? How do you see this kind of program?
Well, the program that I'm a part of looks at trying to play upon the students' interests at a very younger age, especially at the middle school level. We're looking at grasping those kids and allowing them to explore their natural curiosity in a way that hopefully will help promote their interest into the high school and then possibly into a career beyond high school level.
So how do they respond?
For the most part, very positively. It is challenging. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at the acronym and you're looking at all those letters, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, possibly, you know, research and scientists in a lab doing some pretty intensive work. But when you really break it down to the essence of it, you know, kids are natural scientists. They're always exploring and asking questions. It's just in a program such as the one that I'm a part of, we're allowing them to take those interests and those questions and build upon it in a way that is non-threatening and in a way that they're going to learn about science in a way that's going to drive them to hopefully want to stay interested in it, because most times they lose interest when they move on to the high school or the college level because it may seem too hard. So we're trying to break down those barriers of how challenging and difficult it is at an earlier age.
How do you do that? How do you how do you give them a sense that, yes, I mean, this is, I mean, any, particularly any profession like this or any area of interest, that's obviously going to have its difficulty. I mean, okay, I can remember taking chemistry in high school, right?
Right. Yeah, me too.
So how do you overcome that, that sense of difficulty, and how do you ease them into this idea that there's a logic to this, that it's not as, maybe as hard as they might think?
Well, I think a lot of it's being hands-on. I mean, you know, if you think back, maybe thinking about your previous experience and mine, most of the time it was textbook, and you're grinding out textbook material, and you're just looking at the board, and you're listening to the teacher in the front of the room, where you're looking at more of a project problem-based approach, where the kids are, you know, they're knee-deep in it. So they're posing the questions, they're coming up with the solutions. Me as an educator, I'm more of a facilitator, where I provide the opportunities, I provide the resources, and some guidance where necessary, but for the most part, allowing the kids to kind of direct their own course really provides the true scientific experience. And then I think they then can overcome some of that apprehension and fear of it being too hard or being too challenging, or I'm just not cut out for it, which that's not true by any means.
Well, what kind of projects then do they develop? Any particular projects stand out for that matter?
When I look at the program that I'm a part of, we're breaking 6th, 7th, and 8th grade down into different areas. One of the larger projects that we do in 6th grade is we pose this question, how does an active Earth affect the diversity of life? And so you look at a question like that, and you know, it sounds like a lot of words, and then when you really sit down and break it down, it's very involved, because you're looking at Earth processes and dynamics over geologic time leading up to modern age, and then you're looking at how the diversity of animal life, you know, going all the way back to single-celled organisms up to modern day, are affected by that. And then, of course, you throw in the human element now in this last time period, and then you start to allow the kids to recognize and appreciate just how far and how vast Earth history is. And so by having them be able to do lab activities, it allows them to analyze different fossils and look at rocks and just look at evolution in general. They're able to appreciate, I think, all the scientists and researchers that came before that have been able to help them learn what life was like then.
How important, by the way, is that hands-on experience for them?
I think it's the most important, because, you know, you could have kids that, you know, they could be wizards at reading and being able to understand all that, or you know, you got other kids who are able to write very well, but there are some kids that may be challenged by that, and yet when you put something in front of them, they're able to manipulate it physically and analyze it in a different way, so that I think builds upon, you know, different individual student strengths. And so I think that breaks down some of that apprehension that I think comes along with the fields of science, because there's a lot of jargon and a lot of, you know, big vocabulary. And
sure.
You know, so I think by allowing them to break it down into their own words, into their own small pieces, that helps to ease them in and hopefully keeps them on that path.
And by the way, any particular student, not particular names, any particular student or moment that you saw a student whose eyes kind of lit up and said, oh, I get this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's probably the best part of my job. And most of the time when asked that question, you know, as a teacher, I feel like I'm an investor in the future. You know, most of the time I don't necessarily see that all the time in the class. What's most rewarding is when I see these students when they're graduating high school, or I see them later in life and they're saying, you know, hey, Dr. P, I got a degree, or I'm going for a degree in engineering, or, you know, I'm going to be a doctor, or, and maybe, just maybe, I had a small influence in providing those opportunities at the middle school level that helped propel them through high school into their career. That, I think, is the most rewarding aspect of teaching, from my perspective.
Stephen, so you teach physics, amongst other things here, which to me is a, outside of watching, you know, the Big Bang Theory, I'm done. You know, I mean, tell me a little bit about your involvement in terms of developing STEM and particularly ThinStat.
So I met Chad when Virginia Space down at Wallops flight facility contacted me about a program called the ThinSat program that they're developing along with, or that they developed along with Twig Space Lab. And the idea is that for it is twofold. One is to get raise awareness about Wallops and the spaceport that's there. And two is STEM outreach. And so they approached us and asked Salisbury University if we wanted to apply to the ThinSat program. And basically what it is they are allowing us access to space. We can build small little ThinSat satellites. They're about the size of a slice of bread. Put whatever we want in there as long as it doesn't break regulations. And then, great, we our students get to send something into space and get the data back. SU is getting or got a ThinSat, and along with that, we have two STEM outreach schools, one in Salisbury Middle, where the students of those schools also get a ThinSat and get to launch one into space.
So what kind of projects do these students do that they get to send up there?
For the most part, it's completely up to the students.
Mm-hmm.
The program allows for the possibility of you doing like a cookie cutter program or you just pick the sensor, plug it in, and launch it. But you also have the opportunity to develop your own sensors, you know, buy them off the shelf, plug them in, program them the way you want. Some schools in the program are even trying to test different propulsion methods, different ways to try to keep the ThinSat oriented a certain way. So it's up to the imagination of the students.
So now, and this, so describe for me then, if you right, it's set in the rocket. Tell me then a little bit about how that all works. When it begins to collect information, that kind of thing. With that arc that we see when rockets and so on go up into the atmosphere.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why it can be done right now, the program is free for us, which is wonderful. Thank you again, Virginia Space. It goes on just as a ride share, just piggybacking on a rocket, an Antares rocket that's going up to the International Space Station. And of course, the ThinSats are a secondary payload. So once the Cygnus spacecraft is off, headed to the International Space Station, the rocket does what's called a retro burn. So just tries to get in a little bit different orbit. And then it releases the ThinSats at about 200 kilometers above the surface of the Earth.
So in terms of the students, what kind of reaction do you get? How engaged are they? We were talking a moment ago here about his hands-on, and I mean, they get that, you know, feel the rocks and that kind of thing. Is it word? What about your students?
Yeah, very excited. Went to a class to introduce the possibility. There were lots of questions. Most of the class signed up to join in on the project. And, you know, I'm offering some small amount of credit, but the amount of work that they put in and the excitement they had was far beyond what one credit would normally garner from students.
So how important do you think is it, this kind of program?
I think it's invaluable, right? It gives the students a chance to really get invested and do real science, right? And then they can just get a feel for what real engineers do, get a feel for what real scientists do. And of course, it's a really exciting topic. I could set them up at a desktop lab. They could do real science, mm-hmm. but adding space, satellites, and rockets just adds that enormous amount of flair and really gets them interested.
So in terms of what we're looking at in terms of the future, in terms of getting students involved, is this a growing, Chad, is this kind of growing project, set of programs that get done over across the country? I mean, what kind of growth are we talking about?
Well, I think you referenced the report that came mm-hmm. out years ago. Yes, STEM is here to stay. I mean, there's a lot of educational trends that go on. But I think just where we are from a society in the amount of technology that we are inundated with today and looking towards the future, we're going to need a workforce that's going to be very very, very well versed in the STEM fields. And so I think schools, most time education is slow to jump on board, but I mean, if you just go out there and you just Google STEM and education, you're gonna, you know, it's everywhere. And a lot of companies, not a lot of educational companies, are jumping on the bandwagon, providing opportunities and curriculum, which, you know, can help even those teachers that may not be very well versed in STEM provide opportunities for students. So I think that the reach of it now is permeating all the way down to pre-K, which, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, young children. I have two daughters. One's five and one's three. They're little scientists. They're out in the yard and they're finding bugs and they're doing all these things and they're asking and posing all these questions. And so, you know, even at that young age, we have to foster that imagination and those questions, because, you know, we need a society that can do that and ask those questions, because then that will help propel us into the future. You know, when we're looking at space, and you know, there's always questions. I get questions from my students all the time. You know, why do we send these things into space, and why do we do that? And I'm like, well, you have a cell phone now. A lot of that technology, you know, 30 years ago, that's where it was developed. Or you look at the internet, and why did they do that? And you know, that kind of has ties to CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, and you know, all these different things that, you know, we may not necessarily see the importance, we benefit from in the long run. And you know, there's a generation of engineers and architects and designers and researchers and doctors who are going to be retiring. We got to make sure that we continue to have, you know, viable employees in those fields. And I tell my students, you are the next generation. And so you have to, you know, fill this void that's coming. And going back to what Steve was saying about ThinSat and allowing the kids to actually, or students to put things into space, that justifies what we're doing. Because most of the time, if you're just building a little model and it's just sitting on a table, there's not much involved. But when the kids can say, hey, it went to space. I mean, you know, that's that major connection that I didn't necessarily have growing up. You know, so now the kids nowadays, with all the advancements that we have, I think that is really driving a greater interest. And it's just a need. It's a need of our society and our country.
And by the way, now you should have... Students participate in STEM and ThinSat at all?
Or? Yeah, we started to participate in the fall, and so we got the kits, and we are a little bit slower on the process. There have been a couple of delays, but and actually I was out at the end of the year for some personal reasons, but we're looking to move forward this fall with my seventh graders, who will be eighth graders, in completing that and hopefully getting it on the next launch. So, mm-hmm. but when the kids saw it, they were amazed at the size, how small everything is. And then when told about the process and what it actually will result in, they were blown away, because it goes back to that. You mean it's actually going to go into space? It's going to be on a rocket, and you know, it is going to take a time. There is a time period, but that's building up the anticipation. But they also have to understand that, you know, science is a process, and that it's not instantaneous like everything else seems to be in the world nowadays. So, you know, there's a lot of underlying lessons that are involved in a lot of this stuff. So they're excited. I'm excited. I'm just glad to be a part of this with the kids, because like I said, ultimately, I just stand in the back and just smile, you know, while they're doing all this stuff.
Steve, you get that sense from the people, from the students that you work with, that there's that enthusiasm? That, and is there a particular kind of student that really gets into this, or is there some cross section, or is there just some people who are naturally inclined to be interested in science, or is it? I mean, what do you? How do you read that, if you can read it at all? I don't
know. Yeah, it's a lot of questions there.
But yeah,
I'm not entirely sure. I would say that at least in the physics department, everyone was super excited.
Right.
Everyone joined the program, but in general, they're very excited. But I don't think there's any particular, just that most people, I would say, think space is fun and want to participate.
Right. What about you? Because you see all these students from backgrounds.
I think at my level, it's going back once again, I think that's where at the middle school level, they're old enough to kind of appreciate, but they're young enough to still imagine. You know, they're not to the point where in high school they have a lot of other things going on, social, and, you know, so there's some of this, you know, I don't want to be perceived as or whatever. So at the middle school level, they're still innocent enough to where I think you really push them hard to go and foster that imagination, that creativity, or that interest, which, like I said, once they leave me in eighth grade, I it's kind of like letting my kids off. I'm hoping they're going to carry on with that, and that the high schools are going to do their job and help promote them and prepare them for that. But at the middle school level, I think that is the essential time to really capture that imagination that they're bringing from the elementary school and using it in a way that's going to help solidify some interest so they can become physics majors or go into chemistry or go into whatever there is, because there's just so many fields out there now that fits into this STEM mold that's available.
I mean, 'cause one of the things that strikes me, particularly about modern technology, is that we are used to the idea that it's around. We don't really think about how it works. So right. The cell phone is probably the classic example. I mean, right. I'm old enough to remember when, there were telephone booths.
Right. Yeah, right? Me too. Yeah.
I mean, is there a curiosity with this generation about how these things work, or do they simply accept that they work and they're not necessarily as inquisitive? I mean,
well,
I don't know.
Well, there's a movement called the Maker Movement, okay. which is looking at making in education or just making in general. And this harkens back to almost the days of shop classes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have maker spaces where, you know, people can sign up like a gym membership and all the equipment is there for them to use. They become trained on it and they use laser cutters, CNC machines, 3D printers, you know, then a full wood shop, metal shop, and then build whatever you want. And I think with this now permeating into the educational arena, it's allowing kids to get their hands on things and to figure out how things work. Because I ultimately think, you know, when we're looking at sustainability and limited resources, you know, hopefully down the road, companies and corporations are going to start building things where things could be just replaced instead of, or I should say, repaired instead of just replacing them. And so I think getting the kids interested and being able to take things apart, see how they're built, and then actually being able to incorporate new design into it allows them to increase that creativity and then start to understand the mindset behind engineering and design. And then that leads into a whole nother field of expertise.
So, Steve, I pose the same question. Is there a sense of, obviously, you have physics students who are interested in physics, not for the atmosphere, but, right. but in general, that there is a sort of acceptance that there's a sort of new environment and they use the equipment, as it were, or they use the sort of cell phones, but not necessarily wondering how it all works? Or is there more than that? I mean, I don't know, in terms of students, because you come in contact with more students than most people.
So I think that, technology being more and more important part of our lives does make the students more interested to understand it and to participate in it. But as our technology advances, it's also harder for me to say, oh, this is how it works. Not that I don't understand. It's just that up until the integrated circuit, so if you think of cathode ray TVs, the big heavy ones from 20 years ago, telephones that were actually connected to the walls, all of that can be explained with simple introductory physics. The first two semesters of physics in college perfectly explains all of it. You get to the cell phone and how all the radio signals work and all the computer science involved. And I can kind of point and say, hey, this is about where, this is the field where you're going to answer that question, but I can't just sit down and answer it in 5 minutes like I could with older technology. It's kind of a trade-off. They're more interested, maybe, but it's a lot harder for me to give them a concise, serious answer.
I mean, is this, I mean, it would seem to me that this is, and it's an understatement, but this is far more complex as a world, and particularly in terms of technology. I mean, I can remember when there were like carburetors and you could right. fix your own car. Well, forget that, right? Is it just that the world has become so much more complex?
I would say, right? We use a really complicated tool to make a more complicated tool to make a more complicated tool. I would say that it just things are getting more complex, more interconnected. Maybe not everything. Mm-hmm. Our technology, our cell phones, and whatever else are getting more complicated. But certainly there's lots of other things that are maybe getting simpler. Like I would say light bulbs are getting simpler.
Right. That's what I was going to comment on that. You're right. The behind the scenes, the complexity is immense. But to the end user, it's very simple.
Right.
And I think, for the vast majority of the public, that's fine. And that may be fine from that perspective, but I think when you're looking at it from, an educational perspective or you might want to know how it works because it's going to break. And I think it goes back to one of the things we talk about throughout the 3 years in my program is sustainability in the environment because, that's very important. They're 30 years from now, they're going to be basically my age and they're going to have to deal with a world, 30 years down the road with all this technology and all the, the effects of it, whether it's positive or negative. That's one of the things I try to incorporate in the class is, how do things work? And that goes back to that maker mindset too, of being able to take things apart. But when you bring in an old rotary phone, it is a dinosaur to them and they don't understand that. And, right. We're getting to the point now as you know, we're moving further into the 21st century, those things that we, as young kids, took for granted, or, you know, the cathode ray tube, TVs and all those things, or, you know, a cassette. You know, just, you see on Facebook, you know, people put, hey, if you know what this is, or the pencil in the cassette rewinding the tape, you know, that dates you. And, you know, when you bring those things in, or I even mention them in class, because I'm an 80s kid, and, you know, I love those old retro games, and, you know, I have a lot of that stuff. And when I talk to my students about that, you know, they're blown away by it. And so that, how did you live back then? And it's like, just fine, you know, we made it. So, you know, and I'm sure 30 years from now, they're going to ask you, how did you live? So, you know, I think with the advancement is great, but I do think we need to not be ignorant to the idea of how things work. Because, you know, if we're not an informed society with those things, then you could be taken advantage of. And, you know, there's all that other stuff that goes along with the education in general of technology.
Well, in terms of technology, I mean, one of the things that struck me, and I mean, I obviously follow politics and so on, is that the technology, particularly social media technology, has so outstripped everything else that it has transformed how we communicate with one another, who can say what, and so on and so forth. Is there any concern about the impact of all these changes, or does anybody think about these, the impact of what's going to happen, whether or not we should A, obviously do it, but B, what's going to happen? I mean, what about you? What do you think?
Pretty far skew from my sure. expertise.
But
I think yeah. in general, definitely, our technology, I feel like our technology and whatever has outstripped our philosophy mm-hmm. and our thought and how we approach things. And I do think it is at least a bit dangerous.
In what sense, do you think?
I mean, just from like the social media side of things, mm-hmm. we all got all these questions about free speech and how that plays a role and how much of a microphone should be given to these thoughts that maybe general society is opposed to. And those are really thorny questions that we're, as a society, we'll have to solve. And it's to some extent too late, right? The cat's already out of the bag. We're already having these issues.
Right.
It would have been great if we had solved this ahead of time. And I think this shows up in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, Chad.
At the middle school level, this is one of our biggest concerns, because usually this is the first time a student is given a cell phone or access to social media. And so it's great from an educator's perspective for you know, these kids that have their own phone, because I'm like, you have this personal assistant, you could write down any assignment it's due and have it remind you. Two, you need to look something up or whatever, it's there. But then the flip side of it is the whole social media, that's really what they're attracted to. So they're given this device with almost free range to do all, you know, whatever they want, not understanding the ramifications of their actions, because they just don't know. It's just an ignorance that it just goes along with not being taught, you know, how to use it properly. And so that is of a concern at all levels. My wife is a high school teacher. She sees it in high school. But at the middle school level, you know, sometimes I refer to it as like giving a child a loaded weapon, because it can do a lot of damage. And they don't think, because it's very impulsive. You know, even at this younger age, they're very impulsive. I'm sure even at, you know, we as adults are impulsive at times too. But at that age, they, you know, it's spur of the moment, or it's very reactionary. You know, I say, what's wrong with just passing a note? You know, do you want to go out with me? It's, you know, and then if you said no, it was fine. But not everybody needed to know. And, you know, these are the things that are happening yet in a digital sense, where, you know, they're airdropping photos and things. And, you know, if you're in that, or you're in that area, you're getting these pictures too. And so, you know, they just don't understand. And that goes back to how it works. They don't understand how it works. And so I think, you know, that goes back to having them learn all of this as well, which, you know, we could talk for hours on that, on a whole different topic, but social media is of a great concern at the middle school level from all teachers, no matter where they're teaching or what. It is a concern.
I mean, it's almost like the technology is outstripped. I think you indicate, yeah, the technology is outstripped. I mean, so one of the questions becomes not a matter of, you know, can we do it, but should we do it? Is that a question that comes up at all, and either for either one of you guys, whether we should do something or?
So I don't think I'm ever in a position to ask the question for anything that I'm doing.
Right.
But
there are applications to the kinds of things that you do, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's a relevant question.
Yeah.
Even if I say no,
right,
I don't control
right.
the guy next door, and he might say yes.
Right.
So it's tough.
This is where, as a science teacher in middle school, it's assumed that I know all answers to everything. So the kids will ask me all kind of questions, and they think I'm just going to be able to answer all these questions like I'm a walking search engine. But that is some of the questions that the kids ask. And I do an assignment with my 7th and 8th graders, scientific investigative reporting, where every month they're to report on a chosen topic of their choice all year. So some kids look at sustainability, some kids look at genetic engineering, some kids look at it could be other environmental issues. They get to pick a topic that they can go and do research on and report out. So they're basically doing a little 5-minute little podcast type of thing. And we hit a lot of these topics and questions that are on the cutting edge, especially with like AI. You know, a lot of it's now with AI, with Google and Alexa, and we're talking about all these different invasions of privacy and, how is this going to transcend as they get older? And it's really the kids driving this. And so I kind of sit back and let them do all the work and share it with each other, which is quite interesting because that brings up a lot of debate in class. And then we talk about it from, from a citizen's perspective, from looking at it from an engineering perspective or technology perspective. But it allows the kids to really see what's going on around them in their world and how it's going to affect them moving forward.
At least finally, we come back to something you mentioned about looking at the globe, looking at how life and the processes occur. Is there any greater awareness, you think, particularly for the students that you're teaching, of the kind of impact that the technology that we all love is having on the planet? Is there an awareness at that age at all?
I don't know if there's an awareness of how the technology...
I'm not sure.
Well, from a pollutionary perspective, from those types of environmental degradations, yes, they are very aware. However, being aware and being proactive are two different things.
Right.
And, so... We've been working with the kids. Our 6th graders this year have done a capstone project where we're looking at developing a sustainability model for local businesses here in Salisbury on how they're, especially restaurants, on how they're using their utensils and things like that, trying to be more sustainable. So they're actually looking at the economic impact of the difference between washing plates and dishes compared to using disposables and things like that. So they're learning all aspects of it. So it sounds great to say, hey, let's all recycle and let's all do this until, they start talking to people and they're like, oh, well, it cuts into my bottom line. I can't employ somebody. So they're starting to see all these other aspects of it as well. But from a technology perspective, I don't necessarily think they see all of it. That could take a whole year of in-class study to try to get them aware of it. So there's a lot to cover. So I try to, hit the key points. But when the kids bring the questions to the class, I always acknowledge those questions and entertain the discussion because we want them to be scientifically literate. That's my ultimate goal with my kids. I want them to understand the science. So when they're listening to the news, either on the radio or they're reading it online or they're listening to it on TV, they're going to be able to say, I don't know if that's necessarily true, or I would need more information on it. So I want them to be able to think from a scientific thought process so that they're well-informed because they're the ones that are going to be taking care of us when we're older. So I want to make sure that, they have their heads on straight.
That's true. I mean, even if they don't become scientists or whatever, they exactly. at least have that appreciation.
And I think that goes a long way in any field. If you have the more knowledge you have about how things work and the technology works, the more independent you can be and the more productive you can be. Going into physics, I found that my computer science background really helped me. It saved me a lot of work. My advisor wants me to do all of this grunt work. I can write a program, do the same thing, be done a lot quicker. And when I have issues, I can usually solve them myself instead of going